Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Well, as always, another busy week in politics. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Paul Lisnick, and I don't think I'm ever going to start this weekly podcast off by saying it wasn't a busy week in politics, but there's just always so much going on and so much to talk about. So this week, the president kind of resets the war in Afghanistan, takes ownership of it, in my opinion. But let's not worry about what I think. Let's find out what my guest thinks of all that's going on the national front. Richard Gordon, a political strategist who's been in this biz for about 30 years and works for campaigns, knows lots of politicians and understands how they think. And he's returning to the podcast. Richard, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Nice being on.
So always good to have you. So in the world of Afghanistan, the president says no longer is it going to be a time-based or calendar-based approach. We're not going to announce dates we're leaving. It's a conditions-on-the-ground-based approach. I want to get your response to the president's position, because to me it sounded like he was, A, going back to the Bush administration days, but B, really going back to Obama, because it is true that while Obama announced some pullout dates, he didn't really go with it, and in the end, he seemed to shift back to a conditions-based approach. Are we just where we've been?
You know, I think to a large degree we are. I'm somewhat confused about the speech because, you know, the president built it up as a great departure, something totally new. I was expecting something completely different. And what he said was filled with platitudes and, things we all believe in. I mean, we all support our troops. We all want their safety. We all want to beat terrorism. We all agree with those things. But there were no specifics in it. And I think, once again, we see the president just trying to draw such a bright line with Barack Obama that he went back to his 2009 speech, you know, when President Obama was recently elected, in which the president said, we'll be out of Afghanistan in 18 months. Well, I think after a period of time, President Obama realized that that wasn't a very good approach, and he changed his approach. But I think that is what President Trump was responding to, not the later portions of the Obama administration. It's unclear what our goals are, what our mileposts are, how we're going to know if we won or not, which makes the president's declaration last night interesting. It almost sounds like a secret plan that we just don't know what's involved in it.
And that's because part of that is his style, right? I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do. He mentioned in the speech, I'm not going to tell you when we're going to attack, but we are going to attack. He talked about the military having everything it needs, all resources, and his reversing Obama era or Obama administration restrictions. I was trying to sort of determine, of course, I talked about it on our WGN air, but I didn't know what it meant. Did it, you know, that we're going to give you weapons more powerful than we've seen? We're dropping more very powerful Moab bombs? Was he talking about waterboarding? I'm not saying he was. I'm just saying we don't know what he was talking about. We always know he seemed to suggest waterboarding was fine and even worse should be done. And when he talks about reversing Obama administration policies, that's where my mind went as a possibility.
I think you're right. I had a similar reaction to that. I was trying to figure out what he was telling us. I think there are a couple of really important things that that happened in the speech last night. I think the fact that he made it unclear. I understand his overarching point about I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do. I'm just going to do it. But I think he left us with a thought, it could be any of those things you said. I interpreted it as we're going to almost lift the shackles off our military as if they have been tied down, to let them do what they want to do and take care of hostages the way they want to and fight combatants the way they want to. It's almost a scary notion to me. It almost sounded vaguely un-American to me. I don't know if he meant waterboarding. But the other thing that I think is very interesting about what the president said, because this is very consistent with him, is what he didn't say, which is that he has delegated an enormous amount of authority to his military leaders. In many ways, I'm happy about that because I trust them more than I trust him, which is interesting. But, you know, who's going to make the announcement about the 4,000 troops? He didn't. they will. And as we look at other announcements he has made, it seems like there is a massive delegation from him where he's laying out a very broad concept, and then he's allowing his military leaders to fill in the details and basically run the war, a very big departure from Presidents Bush and President Obama.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I said on our air, and actually several broadcasts, he owns the war now. That what happened during his speech was not that he shifted the policy of Afghanistan so much, because I think, as you and I have already discussed, it sounds like there's not been a shift in policy very much. But what he did do was clarify a shift in his own position, which I'll give him credit. I mean, he had to know. He watches lots of cable TV, and he said right up in front of the speech, my initial instinct was to get out of the war, but now I'm sitting behind the Oval Office desk. I mean, he knows he was going to get smacked with all of the tweets he put out between 2011 and the election where he said we had to get out. So he addressed it. But my question to you is, it looks like he owns the war, but at the same time, he's also letting generals make the decision. So is that because if things go wrong, the blame is going on the generals, and if things go right, well, then he owns the war, which he does anyway.
Right, and good luck with that. You are the commander-in-chief. You could delegate all you wish. You could fire generals. You could do whatever you wish. But it's his. By drawing what he has called a bright line between himself and President Obama, he has bought the war. It is his. And for good or for bad, whatever happens, it will be his. It is hard to imagine, under the scenario that he laid out last night, that we are out of Afghanistan before the next presidential election. I mean, it's possible, but to me, it's doubtful. Are we going to really defeat al-Qaeda in this period of time? Are we really going to make Afghanistan not a safe haven for terrorists in that period of time? I doubt it. But I also give him a lot of credit. It was the first time he almost apologized to us. It was the first time he almost said, I made a mistake. By him coming out and saying, as he does, that I listened to people. You know, I came in here with a different point of view, but the Oval Office has changed me, and I listened to people, and I listened to their advice, and I learned from it. I don't know who wrote that, but that is incredibly encouraging. I hope that's true, and I hope that continues. It was a great departure, obviously, from Steve Bannon and the Breitbart people, and a shift towards more reasonable, I would like to think, more reasonable voices within the White House. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. I also think he deserves some credit for how he started this speech and the almost eloquence of it, which is hard to say in dealing with him, but the way he clearly was talking about Charlottesville, clearly talking about race relations, couldn't bring himself to say I was wrong in how I said it last week, but came as close as he could by using the military and patriotism as a cover for trying to say, hey, look, I'm not such a bad guy on race relations. I really do care about this. But he couldn't get himself all the way there. But as far as the war in Afghanistan goes, it's the Trump war. It will be the Trump war. The next election, when we evaluate it, that's how people will look at it.
You know, it's interesting that because I was actually a bit taken aback at first in his opening comments, which I did as I was watching it here in the studios. And I said, this is Charlottesville. We're supposed to be getting Afghanistan, and it's Charlottesville. And I will give him credit for drawing kind of a parallel. If we're going to go off and fight a war, we have to have peace at home. But I actually think that connection was forced. I just think he wanted to address Charlottesville again and once again do a correction, do a reset, let Republicans in Congress around the country who, you know, try to support him every time he gets it right, give him a chance to go, okay, he got it right again. But it seemed to be out of place and disconnected with an Afghanistan discussion when he did it.
Completely. It was a vehicle for him to say something that he felt, I think that his advisors felt he needed to say. I would have much preferred, and I think it would have been the right thing and the appropriate thing for the President of the United States to do an Oval Office speech in which he said to the American people, where he addressed race relations, where he talked about Charlottesville, where he talked about the violence that went on there, where he talked about, you know, the death of Heather Heyer, where he did those things. But he doesn't have the courage to do that, and he doesn't have the ability to do that. And so instead, he forced the discussion by putting it in terms of patriotism and putting it in other terms, which in his way was, let's stop talking about this. This, you know, I've now said everything I could say about this. I'm really not a bad guy on race relations. Let's all talk about patriotism, which we all agree on, and let's move forward.
Yeah.
It's not enough.
I want to get your reaction, too. He talked about calling upon NATO and mentioned once again, I demanded that they all pay more money, and they have paid more money. No mention of Russia, by the way, and it's not as though they're not involved in Afghanistan. And, of course, he triggered some tensions perhaps between India and Pakistan, who are not exactly loving partners of each other. My question is, as he proceeds and counts on our allies, a group of people he has certainly given some concern to, they're not quite sure what to make of the Trump administration. You've been around politics a long time. Do allies come together and say, well, this is about war, we put all that stuff aside? Or do allies look and say, you know what, President Trump, you're going to get a little of your own medicine now for the disrespect you've been giving some of us, because, no, you can't count on us. What do you expect allies to do?
Well, I think the allies, if I'm not mistaken, there are 39 allies of ours involved in Afghanistan. I mean, it's a very large coalition, you know, some very small, some larger. You know, in the country, the leaders I have spoken to in various countries are outraged over his comments about NATO and are afraid about his comments about NATO. There are really only five countries that are paying their full freight. So it's really not a lot. And as far as the allies go, I don't think they will use Afghanistan as a vehicle to vent their anger at how he's dealt with this, and that's because it is so strategically important to NATO. If it continues to be and it grows as a launching pad for terrorists, Europe is more at risk than we are. So do I think they'll use it as a vehicle to get back at him? I don't, but it does make it a lot harder politically for them internally to do what they need to do to send their own children off to fight or their own resources to Afghanistan. I think he's going to have to learn how to curtail some of his anger, curtail some of his rhetoric, and that's the best way to bring our allies firmly into the fold with us.
I want to get your reaction, just a few moments left, but to all of this in the scope of new poll results that have come out, taking a look at critical poll, the states that put him in the presidency, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, job approval ratings as high as 36 in Michigan, down to 34 in Wisconsin, 35 in Pennsylvania, right in the middle. And then another question, are you proud of or embarrassed by the president and his actions? And once again, 63% to 64% embarrassed in those three critical states. The president's going to say he doesn't care about polls. He doesn't pay attention to polls that don't, say good things about him. But how much concern should he have, given the fact that, as you and I have talked about before on the Politics Tonight show, polls are a snapshot in time?
Well, I think he should be very concerned. And speaking about polls, I don't know if you saw, but 61% of Americans before his speech either want to decrease our troops in Afghanistan or keep them the same. So he's running against that also. Look, he has a long time to go to try to get those people back. But, you know, as you and I have discussed on Politics Tonight a number of times, if he doesn't create real jobs for the people in those states, which is really why they voted for him, if he doesn't do something to improve their lives in a very meaningful way over the next couple of years, he is in serious trouble, because that's why they voted for him. They voted for a change. They voted for themselves. They voted for their pocketbooks. And if he's not able or willing to deliver on that, then I think he is seriously in trouble. And not just electorally, because who knows if he's even going to run for re-election. No one really knows about that. But how does he get his legislation through? How does he get a congressman from central Pennsylvania to support Donald Trump's agenda? Well, if Donald Trump is not being supported by the people in his district, you can rest assured that the congressman is not going to support it either. So he is on the fine line of having it be a negative presidency already. He needs to pull those numbers up. It is a snapshot in time, but he has to do something, really do something, to affect people's lives to get those numbers up.
And we're going to see what happens over time. Every day, things seem to be different. But you make a great point, which is, you know, he's continuing a war. Afghanistan looks like it's going to go on for quite some time. And it is not a popular war, not after 16, 17 years at this point. Richard Gordon, political strategist, good friend of Politics Tonight and the podcast. As always, thank you for your insight on that, which has been going on in recent days. Thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
So I know you think we're about to do an interview about the solar eclipse, which we should, actually. If you're playing Let the Sun Shine, we should talk about the solar eclipse. And I might just ask my guests where they were for the solar eclipse. That's not really what this is about. We are about to talk about Hair, the American tribal love rock musical that's playing over at the Mercury Theater, Chicago on Southport. And we're getting to talk about it because it's been extended until September 24th. And it's extended because it's fantastic. And I was there on opening night and absolutely, you know, fell in love with a show all over again that I was a kid when it first came out in the late 60s. But I certainly do remember it. Let me welcome to the podcast Brenda Didier, who is the director of Hair. And I don't mean to make you old, but such a legend in Chicago. I mean, to me, you are between your direction, choreography, not only at Mercury, but at Goodman Theater, Chicago, Shakespeare. I'm just familiar with so much of your work. And actually, Brenda, I think I've interviewed you sometime in the past in another forum.
Thank you so much.
Welcome. And then we get a couple of the stars of the show. Matthew Keffer, who plays Berger, that is the lead of the show. I think you might say that. We certainly see him first, and he plays an important role. He's coming back to the Mercury stage, where you likely saw him in The Man Who Murdered Sherlock Holmes. I saw you in My Fair Lady at the Lyric Opera. So many great shows that you've been in. And then my good friend Michelle Lotto, who plays Sheila, critical role, coming back, making a debut at the Mercury Theater, but after a wonderful run in Spamilton at the Royal George Theater. I'll just give that a quick plug, because even though you're not in it anymore, the show is great. My special on Spamilton, still running on the Comcast Network on Channel 100, and it's a great show for people to see anyway. Don't you agree, Michelle?
Absolutely. People should definitely support it.
All right. Matthew, Michelle, welcome as well.
Good to be here.
So let me, Brenda, I want to start with you, because here's the thing. If somebody's not going, depending on your age group, if somebody's not going to see Hair, they're going to go, well, that thing was around in the 60s. That was like Vietnam War stuff that has no relevance to me today. Why would anybody put that on? I have an answer to that, but I'd rather hear yours.
Okay. First of all, I think Walter was the one who, you know, Walter chooses a season over at the Mercury Theater, Walter Stearns.
Walter Stearns, right.
And I think he was brilliant doing it for many reasons. Number one, it's the 50th anniversary of the show and Summer of Love. There's so many, you saw the show opening night, obviously, there's so many things that are happening in our country right now that are still the same, and if not worse, I feel like we've gone backwards, you know, with our themes in our show of race and violence and peace and love and all, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I was young when this show came out, I never saw the show before, but it touches on something, and it's perfect for right now. And people are leaving, the way I know it is the way the cast responds to it and the way they perform it every night, and now more Michelle and Matt know more than I do because I'm not there every night anymore. It's the way the audiences are leaving and are being touched and moved. And that's when you know you have something special.
I got to tell you, when you can walk out of a show and can't get the music out of your head, you know you've got something good going on. And Hair in this production is one of those shows where you just, I mean, even just listening to Let the Sun Shine In, which we just did, I mean, you just, this music stays with you. And by the way, for listeners who don't know Hair, actually, if you listen to some of the music, you probably know a lot more of this show than you realize, because so much of it is classic and just has been around. I mean, the Fifth Dimension made some of these songs. I'm dating myself with that, too. But made some of these songs so very famous. So, Matt, you play Berger, the key role. Talk, you know what, and again, I don't want to assume people understand the show. So from the perspective of Berger, give us a little bit about the plot of Hair.
Oh, man. Well, I think the plot of the show is a little different from Berger's perspective, because I think Berger is he's that one guy that we all knew growing up, that he is a lot of fun to be with, but it's always got to be his kind of fun.
Right.
I think he embodies a lot of the impulsive nature of the hippies, a lot of the stereotypical qualities that they have. And I think the show is about this tribe, this group of people who have found a connection with each other, a bunch of like-minded, free-spirited souls. And it's about them, you know, telling their stories and going through life during the time leading up to
one of the members is drafted, and it's them, you know, dealing with that. And I think Michelle would probably be better suited to talk about more of the political things, because Berger is very, very hands off on the more important themes of it. Berger's just there to have a good time.
Although Berger gets involved without question. Michelle, your character Sheila, also a pivotal role. So hey Matt, toss it to you. So go ahead and grab it.
I think Sheila, within her role within the tribe and within the show, is she sort of represents, there was a lot of different kinds of hippies within the counterculture of the 1960s. You had beat poets, you had, you know, your hippies that were in the park doing LSD, and you had your, like, hardcore activists who were all part of this counterculture. And I think Sheila has one foot in each world a little bit. She's definitely, activism is her call, and standing up for marginalized groups of people is her call, and actively speaking out against the Vietnam War. But she's still connected to this tribe of people who are all about free love and peace, because there's common themes there. I think she gets frustrated throughout the show about, like, the motivation to do something with those feelings, which is, interestingly enough, like, the kind of, not demise, I don't want to call it demise, because they're still definitely hippies and stuff, but the counterculture kind of stalled a little bit when it didn't turn into very real activism. So I think that's kind of her role within everything. We really do have a lot of people, a lot of tribe members representing different parts of that counterculture. Claude is similar to Sheila, played by Liam Quigley, who's fantastic, in the sense that he kind of has one foot in the world and one foot out, too. So it's just really interesting to watch these people kind of balance what that means. Like, what does it mean to give yourself freedom, but also, like, what you do with that freedom is really important, and that's kind of what defines us as people, you know? So that's one of the reasons I think the show is so relevant, is we have these opportunities now as millennials and stuff that we're connected on a more instantaneous level, and that gives us freedom. So what we do with that freedom is going to dictate the next 50 years of our country's political climate.
Yeah, and Brenda, you know, in part of the promotion for the show, where you gave a quote, and it said in part, the show's a celebration of humanity and sharing in community and an earnest plea for the end of war, for harmony, understanding, and peace. I mean, that's a quote that is relevant today.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's been relevant since, I think it's going to always be relevant. I think human beings, you know, what's interesting about humans in general, we have potential for good and potential for horror, you know, and that's that theme at the end of the show, you know, from Shakespeare. And it just, I think humans are just, we have the power to help, to heal, and we have the power to hurt.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of levels within each of us. All of us have it, you know, and it's finding the lightness and the darkness in all of us, and just one person at a time, you know, do something kind one person at a time.
And by the way, I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, I don't even know. I feel like I'm rambling again.
Okay. Now, the directors.
It's always going to be, it will always be that way, unfortunately. Mm. And, you know, like with America, you know, people, will the American experiment work? Yeah. Bringing all these different people here? You know, is it working? I think we're still a young country and we're figuring it out.
Brenda, would this show have been as successful now if this were the Obama, and I'm not going to get political with you, but the show is political, but just a very brief answer to that. If we were in the Obama years, would this show have been right to do?
Yeah, I think it's always right to do. Okay. I think there's always things that we have to work on. It's just, I don't think we were perfect then. Mm-hmm. We were definitely in a better place, but I definitely think it's always going to be. That's why it's lasted 50 years, and people are young people, old, you know, everyone. I had 90-year-olds that came and were inspired by it, and 12-year-olds. There's something in it for everyone.
Yeah.
It's the human experience. You know, you talk about the tribe. Matt was talking about the tribe. Michelle was talking about it. You know, within a family, like a big Italian family or Latino or any family, Catholic, whatever family you're in.
Jewish, we're all there, I'm telling you.
You fight, you love, you hurt, you know, it's part of being human.
And then you eat.
And then you make up and you eat tomorrow. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just like it's one big family, and they're not, humans are not perfect.
This is true.
Not, but we have to, like, bring out the light in each other.
I just realized we should have food in the show. Maybe at the end you pass around cake or something.
I know.
Matt eats a brownie every day before walking into the theater.
I love it. So I'm just going to stay heavy for a little bit longer and then get some lighter stuff. But, Matt, in your bio, one of the things you wrote, because, you know, you can do anything you want in your bio, and we get your credits and what you've done. But you chose to end your bio by saying, be active in your community, get to know your neighbors. These are frightening times, but you have more power than you know. You know, phrases like that, I mean, I'm going to guess that you wouldn't have put that if you were appearing in the Sherlock Holmes show or something, right? This struck you for this show.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, people often refer to that time period as the protest generation. And I think we are seeing a resurgence of the protest generation now with a lot of the things that are going on with the Women's March and with Black Lives Matter. And I think that we are starting to see again that there is power in numbers. I mean, just the other day in Boston, there was a hateful protest showing up, and we absolutely drowned them out with voices of peace and love. And they it was announced earlier that that they have canceled planned protests in 36 other states, and they are just crawling back to where they came from. And I think that I think we have a lot that we can learn from looking back at that time period, seeing the things that they got right, seeing where we can do even better in the future.
Michelle, when you were one last Spamilton reference too. When you announced you were leaving Spamilton, you at first didn't say where you were going, as we all wondered, and we all thought you would secretly tell us what was going on. but it was hair. So I have to ask you. I mean, Spamilton, probably a lifetime gig. What led you to say, "I'm going to leave this show because this show is hair. It's just more important for me to do right now." Well, I'm assuming that's what you thought.
That's exactly. No, you hit the nail on the head. I love this show. I've always felt I did the show one other time, and you know, not to badmouth any work I've done, but it was like a far less well put together show. Brenda's very good at what she does. And I played Jeannie, and which was great. I love, as you know, from Spamilton, like, I love doing comedy. I love making people laugh. But I've always, like, spiritually felt connected to Sheila. She's far and away the closest to myself I've ever played on the stage. So for me, if that opportunity came up, I wasn't going to let it go. And I worked with Brenda doing In the Heights last year, and it completely changed my Chicago career and, like, the trajectory of my life at this point. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think it's really important to I will always go back to people who I feel like enrich me and I enrich them, and it's like this mutual thing. And I know that maybe I'm speaking for Brenda, but her and I certainly have a connection, and I love to work on this piece with someone like her and someone like Chris Carter doing choreography in 2017 under the Trump administration. I was like, no, there's no universe in which I'm not playing Sheila in this production.
Yeah. And by the way, Brenda, brava on In the Heights over at Porchlight. That was absolutely stunning. Could have run another 8 years, but they too had to move on with the space, as we know. You know, the members of the tribe, such a great cast. I was really struck by Aaron Davidson, who is Wolf. I just think he's just a great job.
Oh, he's terrific.
Really, really great. And then I actually had, the opening night, I had dinner with Henry Godinez and his family, and of course their daughter, Lucy, was in the show. So I did say to Henry over dinner, I said, you know, your daughter will kind of be taking her clothes off in this show. and of course, we talked about it, and, you know, and they said, you know, look, we talked to her about it, whatever. So I guess I'm going to have to come back to Brenda on that. You know, that's a, I mean, it makes sense for the show and everything else, but in an intimate theater, we're not in New York. Was that a risky thing to do? Was that a decision that had to be made, Brenda, those steps such as, and it's handled very, very tastefully. You almost really don't see anything, even though you're people like me trying to see it. No, I'm kidding. But handled very, very well. Was that an issue of discussion with you, Walter, whoever, to say, can we do this?
Yeah, it was. It absolutely was discussion. The minute I, you know, thought about doing the show, the minute I said yes, I said, if we're going to do this, we're going all the way. I'm not going to do a truncated version of hair. We're going to do everything. We're doing the nudity, and he was all on board. Great. How can we make this special in this space and make the actress feel safe and yet not feel like we're cheating anything? You do. I mean, depending on where you're sitting, you can see more than you think, but it depends. But I think it's all about the tastefulness of it all.
Yeah.
You know, and why you're doing it, a wall of protest, a wall of bodies. Mm-hmm. You know, there's beautiful images on them. It's, the human body's a beautiful thing. You know, and I feel like in America, we're just too hung up on all these. We have a lot of barriers.
Yeah, it was actually, it was that piece that kept me from auditioning for the burger role. I just want you to know.
But, you know, also, you know, we reach out to the cast. I think there's equity rules. I don't know if Walter reached out to, you know, Michelle and Matt. And you know, there were some cast members who didn't feel comfortable. We, you know, it's about creating a safe space, right?
Yeah.
Creating, and it's about telling each other, you know, you don't have to do this. Who feels comfortable, there, you're going to put your ear. If you don't feel comfortable, you'll go there. And it all worked out. You know, I don't think anyone feels, I hope they don't feel uncomfortable.
Well, it's not uncomfortable.
You were very upfront from the beginning. Even on our audition notices, it said nudity. And so it was very open and honest from the get. And that's been a theme you guys pushed. Everything was very tasteful, and even in rehearsals, we didn't really do it until a couple days before we moved into the space.
Right.
Which is, I mean, again, it's part of the show. It's not gratuitous. It's not, you know, all the decisions being made. And so the fact that the tribe on stage, I mean, I don't think there's any group category not represented. There might be, but you know, you look up there and it is truly a portrait of America on that stage, Brenda. That has to be part of the skill,
yeah,
of casting and required in casting here.
Yeah, absolutely. We were very blessed to have so many people audition, you know, and then it was really actually pretty easy to choose these 16 amazing actors to do the special piece of work, because what I was really looking for is the rawness and the eagerness and the uninhibited feeling they have to have. And I mean, it isn't easy to do a show like this. I have the utmost respect for them. They have to trust each other like there's no tomorrow, you know. And there is a sense of you have to be. It's just a show. I can't explain what I'm trying to say, right, Matt, Michelle? It's a show that it doesn't come along every day, and you don't do these things all the time on stage. And there's
it's
requiring
Sorry,
a lot of you. You know, anyway, you guys can elaborate if you want.
Let me just, and for the sake of time, Matt, I'm going to come to you with this one. The audience is so critical. Now, opening night when I was there, of course, it's always going to be a great audience. But the energy, the connection between the audience and the cast was palpable. I mean, it was very clear. It was a strong connection. I'm guessing you feel that every night because the energy from the cast is just amazing.
Oh, it's incredible. They make my job very easy, because all I have to do is just show up, and everyone there is just living in the moment. And Brenda did such an incredible job with assembling this cast that for 90% of the cast, everyone was meeting each other for the first time 3 weeks before we opened, and getting up there on that stage, we are absolutely a family. I trust each and every one of them with my life. And we were lucky enough to have enough previews to adjust to having the audience there, that final cast member of the project. And the houses have been great. A lot of people, everyone is just showing up open and ready for what we have to throw at them.
And Michelle, you kind of have this history, as I look back at your resume, of doing big shows in intimate houses.
Yeah.
And that's a really special kind of experience. You have got to connect with an audience in that kind of setting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's kind of what makes a successful show. Like, ultimately, it's like a symbiotic relationship, right? Like, I wouldn't have a job if people didn't come see shows, and people wouldn't be able to see shows unless I had a job. So it's like, our role, I think, is very clear. When we walk into this space, I'm here, you bought a ticket, I'm here to entertain you. But when it comes to a show like Hair, I think their responsibility becomes a little bit more, because this is not a fictional story. This is based off of real people, and this was not that long ago. My mom was like a 10 or 11 years old in 1967, but her cousins were hippies. She had cousins who fled the draft. So it's very real when you're able to talk to people. When I have not to like totally go on a tangent, but we had this older couple who's come to see the show several times now, and we knew as a tribe, I know Matt can attest this, we were like, he was just, the man in particular was sobbing during the finale every night that he saw it. And I made a point the last time he came, I ran down, I changed as fast as I could to hopefully catch him before he left. And I met him, and his name is Greg, and he's this lovely man with his wife, Janine, who, they were hippies, and he was a professor, and he lost a lot of students during the Vietnam War who went away and never came back. And those who did were not the same. And so what we're able to give him, this really cleansing, cathartic experience to relive this, but in a really gentle and, like, I don't know. I think everything we do, even the references to the war and stuff, everything's tasteful. It's cathartic for him. It's amazing for us as actors to see that what we do is not just, we're not just la la da tap dancing up here and like, cool, they left and they're happy and they smiled a little. It's like, this is sticking with people. We're all actually, the cast is going to this man's house this coming Sunday for coffee and bagels.
Wow.
So we can talk more about the 60s.
You know,
because, like, it's important.
That's really cool. And I'll throw this one to anybody who wants to answer it. But you know, you're right. These are real people. And you had people who lived through all of this. And even though, I guess, Brenda and I were kids at the time, but people lived through this. Does it add to your sense of history? Look, I've done some interviews with people who played historical figures on my podcast. I don't want to get into it. But I'll say to somebody, well, did you, you know, I would start to ask them questions about this person's life that they were playing. And to be honest with you, I've had some actors that couldn't answer it. They went, well, I have the script. I can only tell you what's in the script. I really haven't done sort of research on this person I'm playing. And that stunned me a little bit, because I would think one would do research, but that's that person's call. But the question I have for one of you, whether you did it before or now, people like meeting Greg and Janine in the audience, does it make you want to say, I need to learn about this era of our history, if you haven't done some of that already, to realize what it is this country did go through at that time, the Johnson days and all that kind of thing?
Yeah, Matt, start.
Go ahead. Yeah, no, go ahead.
Sorry, we absolutely did a lot of research about the time period, and just to know about the world that it is that our characters are living in. And I think that I think we've been, knock on wood, successful so far, because you know, after the show, people come up and say, "Oh, I know exactly who you are. I grew up with this guy, or I was this person." And I think that. You know, you have to know about the times to live inside of them.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, same?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were all so, that was like, I get such a nerd alert. I'm like, yes, everyone was so game to go there with us and look into all of that stuff. I mean, I think every day I would come to rehearsal and someone was like, I watched this documentary last night and I did this. And like, we were all just so on board to immerse ourselves and do the required reading. I mean, even at my dressing room station, I have the most time off stage of any character. A lot of what Sheila does, it happens off stage, and she comes back and tells people about it. So these protests and rallies and stuff. So like the rally that I come back and have a whole scene about telling the tribe about was a real protest that happened in Washington, D.C. in October of 1967. So, I mean, I got pictures hanging at my dressing room station from that rally. I have other pictures. Like, I understand that for some people, I guess they don't have to do that and they could still give a great performance. And I can't really knock those people if they're able to do that. For me, I just know that I, especially when doing a play like this, I have to know as much about it. I have to put myself there so that everything just feels a little bit more organic.
And Brenda, I you've got such a huge portfolio of work in your career, but I'm guessing that this show and the risks and the support from Walter, Eugene, everybody involved is going to keep this kind of in a special place in your heart.
There's some of the shows that come along that are special, and I've been very blessed. Seriously, each one has been special for different reasons, but this is on a whole new level. This is something that will stay with me. They say it's directors. I did research on people who've directed it, and also actors. They say, I came into the press as an actor, I left a hippie. You know, I came into hair as a director, and it stays in your soul. I still listen to it. I've done shows where I've done the rehearsal process, and I want to hear those songs for another year. I still listen to it almost every day.
Wow.
I fell in love with it over and over again.
Well, I do love this show, and some of you may or may not know, I collect a lot of theater, movie, TV props and stuff. And so one of the props I have on my wall is the torn yellow shirt.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, important prop from the show. It's from Broadway. Always a nice reminder to look up at that and remember a time, because it's important to me to see that. Hair, the American Tribal Love Rock Musical. That's a long name. It's just hair. I mean, I just know it's hair.
Yes.
It is playing. I didn't know it was called the American Tribal Love Rock Musical.
It's pretty, yeah. Paul, really quick, before we go,
please.
Can we just very quickly mention something? So we've been raising money for different nonprofits.
Oh, yes, ACLU.
To social justice throughout the run. We did ACLU the first week. We raised about $2,500. This week we did Southern Poverty Law Center and raised almost $4,000. We're doing Wounded Warriors this upcoming week, and we just want to make sure people know that when they come, they'll have the chance to apply what they emotionally feel into direct action, and that's very important to us.
A show with a purpose and a performance with a purpose. And I'm sorry, I'm glad you mentioned that, Michelle, because that was critical for you to say. And by the way, I follow you guys on Facebook, and Michelle, you're always, so all of you are talking about the important causes and what you're raising money for. So, yeah, come to the theater and enjoy yourself and get a message, but do some good.
Yeah, exactly.
So important. Hair's playing at the Mercury Theater Chicago, which is over on Southport, 3745. Wow, it's so great, too. It's right near the Music Box Theater. It's a great neighborhood. I had dinner ahead of time, as I mentioned, with the Godinez family in the Grassroots, I think is the name of the restaurant, right?
Yes.
Great food, great place to eat just before you go in and watch the show. It's playing through September 24th. It is extended, and you can get tickets at mercurytheaterchicago.com. I think I have that right. I'm just saying that from memory, but mercurytheaterchicago.com. And then all sorts of shows coming up. I mean, Walter, I'm just so thrilled. I love Walter's work and the schedule that you guys perform, that is performed at the Mercury. Great stuff. Congratulations, guys. Bravo on an absolutely incredible job. I loved it. I'm going to try and catch it one more time before it closes, because you just, you know, it's just great. It's just great energy, great music. You guys are phenomenal on stage. And Brenda, congratulations for directing an incredibly successful performance.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right. We're going to go out. I'm going to have my producer, he doesn't know this, but I'm going to have my producer play a little bit of Aquarius on our way out. And because you know what? Everybody knows that. And it's a great reason to say, yeah, I got to go get my tickets before this show closes. So with my thanks to Brenda Didier, Matthew Keffer, Michelle Lotto. Thank you, guys. Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.